This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
How can we know the time of crisis has arrived?
The signs are all around us. You know what I'm talking about.
You don't know what's going on. You've been away for far too long. You can't come back.
As our first guest, Ellen LeConte, says right on the book cover, why so much is going wrong everywhere at once, and how life teaches us to fix it. This is a wise woman with new rules, life rules. After that, and out of an army of trouble facing us, we'll go again to the big one, the developing shift in our climate. Right now, the Arctic sea ice has retreated again as we warm the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. And yet those same oil companies causing the Arctic melt are pushing into the newly exposed waters. What happens when their wells off the cold coast of Greenland blow, like the BP Deep Horizon did in the Gulf of Mexico? Greenpeace has a ship watching over, activists storming the rig in a last-ditch effort to bring our attention to this Arctic oil rush. We'll talk with Vicky Wyatt, climate campaigner for Greenpeace International. And then we'll end up with new research. All the news, this whole media circus, is all about us humans, our faces, our lives, our world. What is happening to the rest of living things as the climate heats up? How do animals and insects tolerate the heat? We'll talk to the investigators, two scientists, with the first clues. 1 hour, three interviews, one goal. Welcome to all our new listeners on stations across North America and around the world. This is Radio EcoShock. Right here on Radio EcoShock, you get news on the converging crisis of our times. We face dangerous weather, changed climate, higher prices for energy and food, plus maybe a double helping of worry about our economy, the value of money, even the government. Our guest, Ellen LeConte, says we have hit critical mass, a kind of buildup that could lead to social explosion or maybe some sort of collapse unless we make some big changes. The title of her book says it all, Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. Ellen, welcome to Radio EcoShock and to Earthbeat.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you on both.
Ellen, this is a great time to talk with you. I've been looking forward to it because a lot of us are struggling to see that big picture that you work on. Early in your book, Life Rules, you introduce the idea of critical mass. Can we start with that? What do you mean?
Yes, we've hit a point unprecedented, actually, in human experience at which a number of forces are bearing down on us or converging all at the same time in such a way as we can't separate them out from each other. We in our own minds and our politicians and leaders tend to think of the problem of climate change or of energy prices and shortages or of food prices or of unemployment and of the whole host of reduced social services, all the things we're currently experiencing. They tend to think of them as being separate and to be handled and treated separately. But that's not really the case. If you dig down and find out what the underlying cause of most of these problems is, you realize that they're all sort of joined at the hip and it is now a critical mass, a point at which, if we persist, everything that we're accustomed to, life as we know it, will change dramatically without our being able to do anything about it.
So we have this serious swirl of problems, and we've been raised to believe our institutions will find solutions. But the bankers and the dictators, the billionaires, the big government, they're stalling. They seem to be making it worse. So, Ellen, you seem to be saying something else is really in charge of events. Who or what makes the rules?
Well, in fact, we like to think at this point, because we are dependent on this globalized economy, we like to think economists do, and that somehow they'll figure out how to heal and restart and grow this global economy that supplies us with pretty nearly everything we need to live and the things that we like to have but don't really need. In fact, what they've missed, and most of us have missed, is that every kind of economy, every size of human economy on this planet is dependent on the largest economy it's part of. And the global economy, the global human economy, is not actually the largest economy on this planet. The largest economy, the largest supplier of goods and services, is actually the biosphere, life itself. And if life, living systems on this planet change dramatically, no human economy can function as it ever has before.
So when you talk about life, you often put a capital on it. Are you picturing a kind of living force like Gaia, or do you mean the scientific description, which might be the totality of biology acting within the laws of physics? What do you mean by life?
I would say both. I would say Gaia is a name, a goddess, a Greek goddess name that was given to that totality of living systems on this planet, on this finite planet, and I capitalize it in the book in order to separate it from just our human lives, from human life. We tend to favor human life over the larger community of life forms on the planet, and sometimes putting a capital on something makes it stand out in our minds differently. We are, as one species, part of that larger capital L life community, and we are dependent on its health and well-being for our own.
And in your book, you took the risky step of comparing our developing troubles to AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. I wondered whether that was going to work, but it seems to. Why did you pick that model of disease, and what can we learn from it?
Well, historically, and now speaking of the history of the whole planet, of living systems, of life itself, as well as of human history, up until the beginning of the industrial era, human communities and natural communities worked on the planet in sync with each other and with the resources and ecosystem services that were provided by living systems. They worked together. And what has happened is that this global economic system, which knows no limits and operates as if it could grow perpetually, runs up against life's rule, which is on a finite planet, no system can grow perpetually. What has occurred as a result of that is that human and natural communities, as they have been, as it were, taken over, diseased by this global economy, are no longer able to protect, defend, and heal themselves as they once were. This is exactly what happens when HIV enters the human body. It undermines the immune system, its ability to heal, to protect, heal, and take care of itself. And these natural and human communities, our natural and human communities, are no longer able to do that. The comparison does hold up extraordinarily well. I was pretty surprised by that myself.
So is there some way that we can work on restoring our immune systems?
The same way that living systems have. Interestingly, life began about 3.9, just about 4 billion years ago on Earth, and it began with single-celled bacteria-like, and in fact, bacteria, microbial living things. For the first 2 billion years, that's all there was on Earth. And bacteria, those microbial tiny little beings, managed three times in the first 2 billion years of life on Earth to globalize and almost put themselves out of business. They created an energy crisis, a climate crisis, and a pollution crisis, much as we're doing. And then somehow life, or this totality of little living things with no brains, learned how to stop doing that. And life built in after that a sort of code, genetic code, if you like, of ways of surviving without living unsustainably, to create economies that would work sustainably on this planet. We can learn from how life did that.
If you are just tuning in, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Ellen LeConte, author of Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once, and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. Ellen, in the spring of 2011, we saw uprisings in North Africa and the Middle East. There have been public protests in Europe, especially in Greece and the UK. But it seems no matter how bad unemployment gets in the United States, or all the tornadoes and storms and the families foreclosed, the benefits being cut, I just don't see much organized public resistance in America so far. Why not?
Largely because although if you read along the lines that I do, and I suspect many of your listeners do, if you read about complex systems and read about the environment and care about those things and read about how any economy is dependent on the natural environment that it's working within, if you understand those things, then you can see what's why a global economy no longer works. Americans have been out of touch, except for attending their national parks, going to their national parks on occasion. Americans, most Americans, are out of touch with the natural world and have no training in or exposure to the idea of complex systems or living systems or our dependence on them. And our leaders are quite happy keeping us in that place of ignorance. And so long as we're in that place of ignorance, we can continue to believe in that American dream of perpetual growth and universal prosperity and cling to it almost like children clinging to a parent they hope will treat them well forever and take care of them forever.
Well, before we get into the way life teaches us to respond, I'd like to wrap up on the question of why so much seems to be happening at once. I can hardly keep track of the jaw-dropping news. How about you? There's just huge developments. Do you see this as a temporary stage?
Well, temporary only in the sense, it's what I call the end of cheap easy. We're at the end of cheap easy fossil fuels, cheap easy water, cheap easy food, cheap easy minerals and metals, all the things that have allowed us to populate the planet as densely as we have, and for some of us to live as well as we have, are about to come into permanent scarcity, unreliability. And that means we simply won't have the things that we're used to work with any longer. And because all of these are occurring, our consumption levels or degradation levels of all of these materials and systems are coming at about the same time. They are converging, these crises, and you hit a point where we simply have, we're living beyond Earth's means. And that's the first time in human history that the entire planet is now at risk of our overshooting what it can provide us with.
So we can see some big storms on the horizon. Ellen LeConte, you suggest there are five ways humanity can save itself. Big media is always telling us to want more, but you say we need to downsize. Tell us about that, please.
Well, one of the things that living systems, those ancient bacteria learned without computers or benefit of brains or any kind of political organization was that one way to survive on a finite planet was to create economies, establish economies that were place-based, that depended on, learned to live within the limits of what was available locally. Living systems, sometimes they get gifts of clouds of dust or rain from elsewhere. I mean, rain travels around the planet. But for the most part, living systems, natural communities, can't import. So downsized economies for bacteria and for humans would learn to live with what they have available to them locally. Every economy would be, every local and regional economy would be based on what was available to it or could be made available without harming the living systems that that economy depends on.
I really like the green economy section in your book, Life Rules. Our impact on the planet obviously isn't just fossil fuels. It's everything we strip out of the earth. You know, I can picture where even in North America, people will go through the dumps at one point to find the metals and the plastics for reuse. I hope they do.
That's right.
But shouldn't things be designed to break down into other useful products or at least some useful raw materials right from the start? Could we do that?
Yes, we could. And there are people that are, there are companies, there's a book many of your people will know called Biomimicry by Janine Benyus, written, I think it's probably almost 10 years ago now. Scientists, innovators, technicians are looking at ways of mimicking the way life makes things and the way life recycles things. And most of what we need to know to be able to change our ways of providing ourselves from a way that is consuming the planet and putting all life, including ours, at risk, most of the information, the teachers, teachings, technologies, tools, most of them already exist.
And we've got to stop putting more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, but we all have to admit our addiction to fossil fuels is very strong. We take it for granted we'll drive down the road to get some more food or something. It's built into every aspect of our daily life. How can we begin to deal with that?
When I began researching and writing this book several years ago, I still imagined that we might decide to do that soon enough. My guess is, although I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, My guess is that until we really start to feel the pinch in terms of prices and unpredictability of, for example, electricity, the price of gasoline, the canceling of airplane flights, until these things in North America hit home, we probably won't really do anything about it. It's clear, certainly here in the U.S., the Congress and the administration, every Congress and administration has failed to deal with these issues. They're not so easy to deal with locally, although it is possible to relocalize energy systems as well. But it means you have to stop thinking your energy systems are going to take you around the world or bring you food from around the world. They become as local and downsized as the rest of your economy.
And you conclude the way we organize socially could determine whether we survive. Are you suggesting democracy is or could be a natural system?
Interestingly, when I was doing the research for this, I was looking for ways to understand how to talk about how natural communities organize themselves, because clearly humans don't organize an ecosystem. All those diverse, very diverse, multi-sized living things, other than human living things, organize these systems that work so well. And one of the central characteristics, and I'm not the first person to say this, there are a number of writings out there that validated my instinct when it came. Natural systems, natural communities, ecosystems tend to be what I call organically democratic. They organize from the ground up, they collaborate, they use resources equitably, relatively equitably. They speak to each other in ways that we're just beginning to learn the secrets of in chemical codes, genetic codes, and behaviors that allow them to work together, despite how different they are, to communicate across their differences in order to create systems that are sustainable over thousands and thousands of years.
Yes, what you've just said kind of took me into the forest and the way the tree roots communicate with each other between trees chemically, but also with fungi that they
exactly.
need to survive. It's all working there together with a lot of signaling systems that we don't really know much about yet.
And just knowing that that's the way it works without yet having to know exactly how it works is a guide for us in terms of organizing most of the decisions that will need to be made as critical mass worsens and as governments continue to fail to make the decisions and policies that we need them to make. We will, at some point, humans will, Americans, Canadians, North Americans will realize, hey, we could do this better ourselves than they're doing it or not doing it for us. And then you begin to really tackle the issues that are important to you, providing food, protecting water supplies, cleaning the air, creating alternative transportation systems. All of these things can be done on a local and regional level when people realize they have to start working together for provisions instead of working alone for cash.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock with Ellen LeConte. Ellen, so many people I talk to realize globalization needs to fail to save the ecosphere, maybe to save us from extinction. How do we deal with that? We're dependent on it, and yet we feel that it must go down and something new must come.
The encouraging thing, although as is the case when any over-large system collapse, there are losses, and among those losses are losses of life. One of the things we bring to that, potentially, as humans, is a kind of caring and humanity, which makes whatever the horrors are that are coming, less horrible. But we also, as a species, have a way, we've done this for 2 million years, of rising to the occasion. When there is an occasion, we know we need to rise to, and when its nature has become clear to us. If we do not proactively make these choices, and the system collapses, the economic system, which pretty much brings down the political systems with it if it fails, then we will begin to do what we need to do because we'll know we need to.
Do you find women talk differently about the future than men do?
Yes. Although, interestingly, a lot of the support for this book and this work has actually come from men and from older men, and I'm not sure why that's the case. But I think the whole focus on life and living things and caring and feeding and supporting, these are things which even now more often fall to women than they do to men. In third world countries, it's usually the women who come to understand these issues before their men do. and begin. Well, I think of Wangari Maathai, who organized the tree planting in Kenya, which turned into a whole green belt movement and gave whole communities, villages, neighborhoods, and cities in Kenya the opportunity to organize themselves to support themselves when their government wouldn't do it. It's Vandana Shiva in India. Many of the leaders in the work that we're talking about that needs to be done are women.
And a lot of women lead in the ecology movement as well.
Absolutely. Many of my colleagues, supporters, people with whom I am exchanging support, one book for another, conference speaking, recommending, critiquing, many of the people with whom I'm doing that are, not surprisingly, women.
All right. Well, you know, we followed some similar tracks, Ellen. I see you were a writer and a homesteader in New England, and you got to know Scott and Helen Nearing, the homesteading couple who inspired so many people. Maybe we should back up a little bit for the younger crowd. Who were the Nearings?
They were what were called back in the 20th century, which already seems, you know, a very long time ago. They were in the middle part and toward all the way almost to the end of the 20th century, what were called 20th century pioneers. In the Great Depression, Scott, who was a professor of economics, and Helen, who was a violinist, a concert violinist, and the spiritual teacher J. Jiddu Krishnamurti's first girlfriend, which is an interesting sidelight. But Helen and Scott met. She was 20 years his junior. He was ready to retire from the world that was disappointing him economically during the Depression and wanted to be no part of child labor and other activities that were trying to bring us out of that Great Depression. Helen and Scott retreated from New York to Vermont and took up a sustainable lifestyle, and then very cleverly in the late 40s began to write about it and wrote a series of books called the Living the Good Life series, which actually Living the Good Life, the first book, has been in print, I think, for 60 years now. And it was sort of a Bible for the Back to the Land movement in the 60s and 70s. So the Nearings work, and they there's a Good Life Center I helped to set up in Maine at their last forest farm in Maine, where people go to learn some of the techniques of homesteading, organic gardening, and some communitarian activities as well.
And you wrote two books about the Nearings. Can you tell us the titles so people can follow up?
Yes, I don't know whether there are many of them, many copies even available now. One was called On Light Alone. Helen, toward the end of her life, she was a very spiritual woman, Buddhist theosophy influenced, and she spoke at the end of her life of wishing she could live on light alone, like the flowers and the vegetables in her garden. That one talks about the end of Helen's life and her good death. And the other, Free Radical, was about Scott's end of life. And both of them were as committed to a good death as they were to a good life, which is why I wrote the two with issues of aging and dying as part of the conversation.
And Scott lived to be what, 100?
He was 100. He died at home 3 weeks after his 100th birthday. He was determined to hit that post that at the end of his life, and he did very quietly in a Chaise Lounge, and then in a cot at home with Helen and other good friends by his side. He quietly went to sleep, and his kind of end-of-life teaching, do the best you can in the place where you are and be kind, stands the test of time pretty well, I think.
You bet. I'm going to write that down. You know, you also have some interesting articles popping up in your archives at ellenleconte.com. What's going on there? What are you putting in there?
These will be pieces, some of which will be sort of a life rules blog. I've got an environmental novel that I almost got sold a few years back that didn't quite make it that I'm uploading. But they'll mostly be pieces about what people are doing to deal with these problems, the crises that we're facing, ways of thinking about them that are fresh ways of thinking. My writing, others writing along those lines, and a continual sort of update of the way things are getting worse even faster than I expected that they would, along the lines of things that are no longer cheap and easy for us.
And do you have a new book in the works as well?
I'm going to start, I think, with the pocket version of this book. something that can be carried around and easy for people to digest, which will have sort of a translation of life's rules for economic survival, which are detailed in the current book, Life Rules. But I think those can be broken out as a sort of 10 commandments of living sustainably, and that'll be called the Little Book of Life's Rules.
Ellen, is there anything else you'd like to add as we wrap up?
Only that I think I am amazed always by human resilience and our capacity to love each other through difficult times and find ways to survive them and learn from them. And I still believe that that's difficult as this time ahead may be. That will be what comes out the other side, will be our ability to rise to the occasion.
Yes, we may even find our hearts grow larger with more difficult times.
It happens always, mostly in difficult times.
Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex Smith with Ellen LaConte. We've been peeking into her book, Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. Find out more at ellenlaconte.com. And that last name is spelled LaConte. Thank you so much for sharing with us, Ellen.
Thank you so much for asking such thoughtful questions, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, saying thank you for listening. How could it happen? The sea ice has barely exposed the fragile Arctic Sea, and the very industry responsible for the big melt is already rushing into the iceberg-laden waters. It's another risky move for the oil addicts that rule the world these days. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Greenpeace climate campaigner Vicky Wyatt. Welcome, Vicky.
Hello there.
Despite some brave action by Greenpeace, which we want to hear about in just a few minutes, I'm betting most North Americans just don't know about this early oil rush into Arctic waters by an energy company based in Scotland. Vicky, can you give us an introduction? Who are the players and what are the stakes?
Well, Cairn Energy is a small oil company based in Scotland, and they made their money in India. And in the last few years, they've turned their sights to the Arctic and the oil that lays beneath the ice there. And Greenpeace are really concerned because Cairn Energy are leading the way into the Arctic, and other oil companies such as Shell and BP are really watching what they're up to. And they're a very, very small company, and they don't really have any experience, as nobody does, of drilling in this very remote and cold and icy location. And Greenpeace are first and foremost really worried that if a similar spill to that happened in the Gulf of Mexico happened in the Arctic, there is absolutely no way that Cairn would be able to contain and clean up the spill. And that would have a devastating impact on the Arctic. And as we know, it's home to species such as polar bears and narwhals and lots of other species that don't live anywhere else on the earth.
So this company is small. It wouldn't have the resources, the money, or the equipment to clean up if something like a BP Deepwater Horizon accident happened off Greenland.
That's right. So, for example, BP last year, when the spill happened in the Gulf of Mexico, had something like 14,000 ships. A huge amount of money. It cost them something like $40 billion to contain and clean up initially the spill. Cairn have nowhere near those kinds of resources. Last year when they were drilling in the Arctic, they had no more than 20 vessels in the near vicinity of where they were drilling. So to think that they would be able to respond on the same scale is pie in the sky. And added to that, the Arctic is obviously very different. It's much colder, which means the oil behaves differently. It's very remote, which means it would be much more difficult to get help out there to try and contain the spill. But most importantly, as we know, the Arctic freezes over. So there's a very short space of time during which they can drill. And so if there were to be a spill, they would only have a very short time to be able to drill the relief well, which is a new well which would enable them to cap the well with the problem. And there's no way they would be able to drill that relief well before the ice covered over. So they'd have to wait till the following year. So in essence, that means you'd have a couple of years of a gushing well into the Arctic wilderness before anybody would be able to get to it and cap it anyway.
Who gave them permission to drill there?
Well, the Greenland government is responsible for licensing oil in the region, but you know, we have to keep the focus as well on the oil companies here. It's these companies that are going to the ends of the earth, to places like the Arctic, to look for oil and drill for oil. And, you know, we really need to see a signal from governments across the world that this isn't the energy source that we want to go after, that we need to be turning our attention to investing in much cleaner sources of energy.
Well, how is Greenland governed and why are the Danes involved in this?
Well, Greenland isn't fully independent, and the Danish government has some jurisdiction over some areas of their government. But in terms of oil and licensing companies to drill and explore for oil in Greenlandic waters, that is a decision and a power that the Greenland government has themselves. But the Danish government, for example, is responsible for defense of Greenland and for its foreign policy.
But WikiLeaks has released some documents from the U.S. cable collection saying that U.S. diplomats believe Greenland, quote, is on a clear track to independence and see this as, quote, a unique opportunity for American gas and oil companies to get a foothold. That looks like America's watching to see whether they can get a chance at this Arctic gold mine.
Yes, and that's a really good point. And so the big powers, the US, Russia, and others, are eyeing up the Arctic. They want some of the oil that's there. And, you know, it's important that we remember this, that our dependence on oil is a dependence on a very insecure source of energy. Those WikiLeaks cables revealed the potential for armed conflict over these resources. Now, if countries don't want to go down that road, we need to start investing in cleaner sources of energy and not relying on oil, which is becoming increasingly hard to get and increasingly expensive, as well as the obvious concern around its role in driving climate change.
Well, it seems fantastic to think about a war in the Arctic, but it could happen. And I know that Canada has spent about $36 billion on some fighter jets it really doesn't need. And they say it's partly to protect the Arctic. And I have to think that oil is behind that. Have you heard anything about Canada's role in all this under the government of Conservative Stephen Harper?
Well, we certainly know that Canada, along with Russia and the U.S., as revealed in the WikiLeaks cables, are one of the countries who are turning their sights on the Arctic and who are interested in exploiting the resources there. And, you know, this could turn into a huge geopolitical issue. And what we need governments like the Canadian government to do, it's in their interests not to be dependent on such an insecure source of energy. And they need to start investing in cleaner energy that's easy to produce, that's cheap, that's safe, that's secure, gives them a secure supply of energy, and that isn't responsible for huge amounts of carbon emissions that are creating and causing climate change.
Vicky, what about the people who actually live there, the Inuit? They have a fishing industry in that strait, I'm told. Have they come up with some worries on this one?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's another good point. An oil spill, as we saw in the Gulf of Mexico, had a devastating impact on the fisheries and tourism industry there. And so whilst oil companies love to showcase the economic benefits that, for example, drilling in Greenland could have for the Greenland economy and for the Greenland people, it's not really the Greenland people who will see the bumper profits that oil exploration will produce. Yet it's the Greenland people that will have to carry the risks and pick up the consequences, for example, if there were to be a spill. And there's a much broader point here. Oil and other fossil fuels are one of the main contributors to climate change. And the effects of climate change are being felt most acutely in the Arctic, namely the retreat of the sea ice there. And the retreat of the sea ice is threatening the livelihoods and the way of life of the people that have lived there for centuries. And so to think that oil is a pathway to sustainable development for Greenland is really a misnomer. We need to look at other sources of energy that we can invest in that are cleaner and that are more secure.
I was reading some news about this cairn oil drilling experiment, I would call it, and it sounded like they had to tow away icebergs every day from the drilling area. It's called Iceberg Alley. Can you tell us about that risk?
Yes. So Cairn, where they drill, some of the wells that they're drilling, there are huge icebergs floating past, and they have to use a number of methods to make sure that a catastrophic incident doesn't happen. So, for example, they will have vessels that tow icebergs away from the drill site. They'll use water cannons to try and change the direction of a floating iceberg. I mean, this is a real gamble with the Arctic and with the wildlife that lives there. And, you know, some of the pictures, for example, that our photographers that have taken that are out there just show the craziness of this situation. Here's a company that's drilling deep into the Arctic Ocean, that's water cannoning icebergs out of the way.
And then there's the problems of the big storms in that region. In November 1981, the most advanced drilling rig of its day, the Ocean Ranger, was sunk with all 84 hands dying. No rescue was possible in those waters. This Greenland drilling must be just as unsafe for the workers.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the weather out there is certainly extreme and poses a huge threat to the safety of these operations. For example, our climbers are hanging right now in a pod off of an oil rig off of the shores of Greenland. Last year, our climbers had to come down because of the severe weather. This year, we've rigged a pod onto the bottom of the rig, so our climbers have a safer and more secure environment in which to take direct action. But yeah, the weather poses huge difficulties out there, that, you know, gale force winds, rough seas. And so it's important for people to remember this extreme environment in which oil companies are operating and the problems that poses. And not only are they drilling, you know, a mile and a half deep into the ocean, they're being buffeted around by extreme weather. And if there was a spill, that's going to have an impact.
This sounds like the BP disaster in the Gulf Times, too. And what about the tankers? They're going to have to move this oil around. I presume that'll mean more tankers are moving around in those icebergs as well?
There's certainly that is also an issue alongside the rig and the chances of a blowout in one of the deep water wells.
Vicky Wyatt, scientists I talked to were shocked, some even afraid, when the ice peeled back so suddenly in 2007, and it has continued to set low records even in the winter of 2010. The last November, December, it was thinner than they've ever measured it. So don't you think it's just amazing and bizarre that the very carbon emissions that caused this ice to retreat is now bringing on the oil companies to make a buck out of even further global warming, it sounds to me?
Yes, well, this is the irony of the situation. I mean, it's madness. It's like pouring gasoline on a fire. The thing that is causing the Arctic to melt and the thing that's causing the Arctic to change as we know it is allowing companies such as Cairn Energy and others to go in there and explore for more oil and squeeze the last drops of oil from these places.
Well, listeners, we have to take a little detour here. Our media failed to tell us in headlines 5 inches tall that carbon emissions are still growing so rapidly, we may have lost all hope of maintaining this ice on the Earth. The International Energy Agency, and it's hardly regarded as anything environmental, has warned the supposedly safe limit of 2 degrees C warming is, quote, a nice utopia. That's according to IEA chief economist Fatih Birol. Vicky, I thought the recession in the West reduced global carbon emissions. Now we find they rose above 30 gigatons in 2010, a new record. What is happening with emissions?
Well, the figures that indicate that the emissions are rising and peaking is obviously very alarming, but so is the IEA's response, and it's exactly that kind of thinking that is getting us into this mess in the first place. The idea that 2 degrees, that limiting any rise in warming to 2 degrees, is now out of our reach. The fact is that we still have time to make choices, to invest in cleaner energy, to go beyond oil, that could limit warming to below a 2 degree increase. Politicians and governments across the world need to take action to ensure that the investment in cleaner forms of energy takes place. And the IEA's defeatism in the face and saying that there's nothing that we can do isn't true. Their politicians have the power. We're at a crossroads. We don't have to be pursuing drilling in the Arctic. We don't have to be ripping up Canada's forest to get to the tar sands beneath. And we don't have to be drilling miles deep into the ocean. These are choices that we are making, and there are other alternatives, cleaner alternatives that are out there that we could be investing in, and there's still time to curb our carbon emissions and to allow economic sustainable growth by other means and not by chasing the last drops of oil.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock from London. Our guest is Greenpeace climate campaigner Vicky Wyatt. Vicky, let's get to the fun but serious stuff. Tell us about the Greenpeace actions along the way and then now off the coast of Greenland. Maybe you could start by describing this drilling rig, the Leif Erikson.
So the Leif Erikson is the only drilling rig to be in the Arctic this summer, drilling for oil deep in the Arctic Ocean. It's about the size of a small cathedral. It's a huge, huge, rusty, ugly structure, and right now two Greenpeace activists are hanging off of the rig right by the drill bit in a yellow capsule, and they're preventing the drilling rig from beginning to drill in the Arctic Ocean because we want to send a message to Cairn Energy and to the world that we can't keep trying to squeeze out the last drops of oil and we need to start investing in cleaner energy.
What Greenpeace ships are involved in this campaign?
We've got two Greenpeace ships up in the Arctic at the moment, the Esperanza and the Arctic Sunrise. And both are being closely shadowed by Danish naval ships and Danish helicopters watching our every move. The RIBS launched off of the Esperanza at the weekend to get our climbers near the rig and to safely secure the pod on the underside of the rig so that we could stop the drilling. And we've got nationalities from all across the world on the ships, from the UK, from Norway, from America. So it's a real international effort.
I've been aboard the Arctic Sunrise. It's a beautiful icebreaker with its own enclosed helicopter pod, so I'm sure that's a good support ship. Are you getting good public support, or is there much press coming out of this in Europe? Are people really paying attention to this issue in Europe?
Well, we've had a great response to our activists and to the action that we've done. And one thing that struck us at Greenpeace is that people are so angry that oil companies like Cairn are going up to the Arctic to drill for oil. The pictures of ships water canning icebergs out of the way, pictures of the wilderness and of the wildlife that's at stake up there, makes people realize the madness of companies going up there to squeeze out the last drops of oil, and makes them question why there is such resistance to investing in cleaner sources of energy.
There's so many angles to this story. Is there something that I've missed that you'd like to add?
There are very simple things that we can do to stop places like the Arctic being put at risk. So it's not just about investing in cleaner sources of energy, but you know there are very simple technologies and measures out there that would mean that we can use less oil. So for example, we can make the cars and vans that we drive much more efficient, and there are laws being discussed in Europe in the next few years that seek to do just that, and the car and oil companies have lobbied very, very aggressively against those laws because they want to keep us addicted to oil. They want to keep drilling in the Arctic because it makes them money. But what we're saying is there are measures that we can take that are good for people because they make the energy that we use cheaper. They make us use less of the expensive oil, and they're also good for the climate and will help us to reduce carbon emissions and prevent climate change.
You just heard from Greenpeace climate campaigner Vicky Wyatt on what may be the last battle to save a livable planet. Greenpeace is protesting an early effort by Cairn Energy to drill in the dangerous Arctic Channel off the west coast of Greenland. It is known as Iceberg Alley. Unless the public wakes up and gets busy, the plunder of the Arctic oil begins, no matter what the risks of spills or extreme damage to our atmosphere and climate. Vicki Wyatt, thanks so much for giving us this update.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our blog, ecoshock.info. And you can go to greenpeace.org to follow and help this campaign to stop dangerous Arctic oil drilling. Thank you for listening.
Instead of just letting you and all your liberal listeners attack our glorious oil companies, our great American oil companies.
Serious climate scientists, whole academies of science from many countries, now predict the world will warm by 4 degrees centigrade this century. That's about 10 degrees for those of you on Fahrenheit. That means hotter, meaner summers for you and me, more records, more heat deaths, more drought, and more crop loss. The little creatures are finely attuned to heat. It's a timing signal, a challenge, and for some, a threat of extinction. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We hear way too much about how climate change will impact humans. What will happen to our cities near the rising seas? What about our food supply? But what about all the other gazillion species sharing space on this little planet? Hardly a word about them. That's why I was pleased to hear of new scientific research into the heat tolerance of wild animals. Can they handle a 2, 3, or even 5 degree rise in temperature? And for that matter, how do animals really cope with heat? Our guests are PhD candidate Jennifer Sunday and Dr. Nicholas K. Dulvey, associate biology professor at Simon Fraser University in Canada, and he's co-chair of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Along with Amanda E. Bates from Deakin University in Australia, they've just published a paper in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And don't let this title scare you off, Global Analysis of Thermal Tolerance and Latitude in Ectotherms. It's about the heat tolerance of animals. I'm hoping to find out how a thick-coated bear survives if summer starts to reach tropical levels, or maybe a hairless ape dressed in blue jeans. You can see how this matters. We have Nick Dulvey and Jennifer Sunday with us on the phone. Let's start with you, Jennifer. What was the big question that drove this research?
Well, the big question we wanted to answer is how animals' physiology changes as you look around the globe. And we wanted to address some key assumptions that people are making in how animals are adapted to the environment in which they live. In our case, we started out very humbly. We just had a few marine organisms that actually Amanda was looking at, and she was looking at some patterns in how their heat and their cold tolerance changed based on where she had collected them and with latitude. And we wanted to see how that would compare to other animals around the world. And so we started to collect this data set, and as we did it, we realized the importance of trying to test these patterns and how heat tolerance changes with, for example, in our case, latitude, and sort of how animals' physiology interacts with where they're actually found.
So if you throw, Jennifer, a bunch of marine animals into one tank and the tank's a certain temperature, do they all end up being happy there?
That's a good question. No, I mean, it does depend on, to some extent, where they're found. And one of the findings of our study was that marine organisms, and so if you're picturing taking marine organisms from different latitudes, they're not going to do as well if you try to put them in the same environment. But what we found with terrestrial organisms is, at least if you're looking at heat tolerance, that they're going to be able to survive nearly the same short-term heat shock, no matter where they were found, in terms of latitudes, from the equator up to the poles.
Okay, well, let's go to Nick, if we can.
Hi.
Hi, Nick. I see your interest in the conservation of nature, and there are many species expected to go extinct due to climate change. Do the results of this study have some bearing on that? Is there some way we can apply this?
Indeed. We heard a couple of years ago that, you know, somewhere around 20% of species are on land are likely to go extinct due to climate change within the next 80 or so years. That's a prediction. It's not an observation. And that prediction was based on how shifting envelopes of temperature as they move northwards are going to bring animals with them and, in actual fact, carry them beyond the limits of continental land masses and into the ocean. So basically, butterflies disappearing into the ocean was the basis for that prediction. And the prediction's absolutely founded upon trying to understand the link between thermal physiology and geographic distribution. And while there are piecemeal studies of upper and lower limits to thermal tolerance in some species and in some locations. It's never been generally clear that there are some overall broad patterns. People have always questioned whether it's a feature of that particular group of frogs or that particular location. And you know what Jennifer's done that's incredibly novel in this area of ecology is not just to look at one case study in one location, but to bring together everybody's case studies and analyze them with a common framework to really understand if there is a general pattern across all of these cold-blooded organisms across the world. And, you know, this search for patterns is called macroecology, and the implication is that when we see such a strong common pattern that there will be some underlying mechanism that we'll be able to further understand. And, you know, so this is really a fundamental piece of research that helps us understand the basis linking seasonal variation in temperature to animals' capacity to cope with temperature at different locations around the world. So ultimately, this will all underpin better predictions of how species will respond to climate change in the future.
And do I understand you correctly that this paper was based on cold-blooded species as opposed to bears or other things?
That's correct. To be honest, we're pretty humble marine ecologists ourselves, so being dragged kicking and screaming into the realms of lizards, frogs, and insects was a big leap already. But clearly, you know, this suggests that people studying the distribution and thermal physiology of warm-blooded organisms should get out and do a similar analysis for those species as well.
Jennifer, I'm told you didn't have to torture any animals under heat lamps to do this research. How did your team get the answers?
That's right. It turns out that people have been doing these studies throughout the century on their study organism or sort of a system that they're interested in. So all we did was collect all the data that we could find through the library and compile them and to sort of keep track of some of the important details of each study to make sure that we were accounting for different methodologies or things like that.
And this was about cold-blooded types of creatures. So did that include, for example, the insects?
Insects is a big part of the terrestrial part of our study, insects, frogs, and lizards.
And did you, in fact, find that there's a similar heat tolerance between those very different types of creatures?
We did. Our major question was how that heat tolerance changes with latitude. But as you suggest, when we put all of the heat tolerances of all of those animals on a plot, they're all relatively similar. But more importantly, the slope, so the decline with latitude, is the same in all of those animal groups, and it's not very much.
I don't think I really understood what you just said. So can you give me an example, perhaps?
So if you look at insects from Canada and the insects of, say, the same animal, same group down in Panama, we found that, and different species of related insects all the way through North America, we would find that the heat tolerance that they're able to, the high temperature that they're able to endure doesn't change with latitude. And then we would find the same pattern if we looked at frogs from high latitudes, mid latitudes, and down towards the equator. And again, their heat tolerance was similar to the insect tolerance, but more importantly, we found that heat tolerance didn't decline with latitude.
Nick, I'm wondering, we've just talked about how similar types of animals have similar types of heat tolerance, perhaps, and we're talking about latitude. Did I read correctly in the literature that an animal that's in the north might experience the same type of heat for a few days that an animal down at the equator might experience for many days, and so that's why they have to have a similar heat tolerance mechanism?
Indeed. So we think there are two possible explanations for this, you know, this similar heat tolerance across latitude. And the first one is, as you described, that animals, even at the highest latitudes, do get exposed to heat shocks, even if only for a handful of days each year. And basically, they need to retain, there's an adaptive value to retaining really high heat tolerance because, you know, you don't have to be cooked for very long to die, which is a permanent loss of fitness. So you need some buffer to cope with that really high levels of extreme heat that occasionally happen, even at the highest latitudes.
And I remember reading a study about how so many of the creatures, including the ones you studied, have a similar body form. I mean, there's a body, there's legs, there's eyes. And so I'm wondering whether this heat tolerance is something that could have developed many, many long ages ago, and then nature, being very economical, just keeps that mechanism going, whatever it makes.
Indeed, and that's the other hypothesis. You know, if you think that the average species has a lifespan in the fossil record of about 1 million years, you know, 1 million years is a long time. It's a lot of climate change. Glaciers have expanded and retreated multiple times during the last 1 million years. And clearly the link between the latitude, or the number of degrees away from the equator, and the temperature in degrees Celsius varies over evolutionary time. And of course, animals have tracked these isotherms up and down over the last tens and hundreds of thousands of years. So we think that this very high heat tolerance could also be an evolutionary legacy of glaciation cycles and so on. And if there's no real cost to retaining that high heat tolerance, then there's no reason to lose it. So at the moment, the challenge really is to try and understand to what degree, and it might vary between different groups, to what degree this high heat tolerance across latitudes is a result of an evolutionary legacy of multiple glaciations on land, or to what degree it's actually adaptive to help the species survive these very rare heat shocks that occur even at the highest latitudes.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, and we're going to Jennifer Sunday. Your new study is about the heat tolerance of land species, but I've read that you've also done some research on another aspect of our carbon dumping, about how marine species adapt to ocean acidification. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I just presented at a conference a paper that's still under review, looking at how marine animals, coastal animals, are going to be able to potentially adapt evolutionarily to ocean acidification. So ocean acidification is sort of it's the elephant in the room for a lot of marine conservationists who are thinking about climate change, because it's sort of the other CO2 problem. As the CO2 is released into the atmosphere, it's also being absorbed by the ocean, and it's a simple equilibrium, and the ocean is becoming more acidic through some changes in the carbon chemistry. We know that organisms are going to be affected. We can measure the effect in the laboratory, and we can say in about 100 years this species is going to have a lower survival rate or a lower growth rate. But the outstanding question was if species are going to be able to adapt through evolution. So what we did was we tried to measure the genetic basis of the variation in how organisms react. So we looked at blue mussels and red urchins from our coast here in Western Canada. We measured the heritability of the traits that we were interested in, so how fast they can develop under a future acidified ocean. And then we did some simulations to see how quickly they'd be able to evolve.
Well, this is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking to two scientists, Jennifer Sunday and Nick Dolvey from Simon Fraser University, who, along with Amanda Bates down at Deakin University in Australia, have released a new paper on heat tolerance. And I'll put a link in my blog where you can find out a bit more about this. And I really appreciate both of you talking with us today.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
We have to wrap this show up. I never got to my big stack of jaw-dropping climate news, the new heat records in the U.S., the early mountain snowmelt in the Rockies that may parch California agriculture, amazing drought in China grounds boats, dries out crops, kills off wild plants, and another big drought in the Amazon means more of that great forest is releasing carbon to the sky and to the oceans. There is even a drought in Europe. Food production there will be down. We don't know if some nuclear plants will have to close this summer for lack of cooling water. Governments are scrambling to respond, but the warming is just too big. We are past that point now, past the point of emergency aid and government plans. The natural world is acting on its own with feedbacks now that we have passed the tipping point. Please keep tuned to Radio EcoShock as we report the big picture for you and find more ways for all of us to bring the big change. As Ellen LaConte wisely said, we humans must rise to the occasion. I'm Alex Smith. Get more from our website at ecoshock.org. Our show blog is ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about your world.
Baby, baby, behavior, attitude.
there, baby.